Hello, this is Irene Bullard, and I'll be reading the normal Bloomington Pantograph, dated Tuesday, May 16th. Let's begin on the front page. Living with chronic pain. Area man minimizes opioid use and turns to treatments and support. Larry Marksman has been to hell and back. When the rural Dawson man was admitted to a hospital in late 2014 for a blood clot in a lung, the doctor on duty didn't allow Marksman to take his chronic pain prescription medicine. "I was on hydrocodone, an opioid painkiller," he said. "I was in the hospital for 3 days without it, and then I was sent home. I went into the worst drug withdrawal," the 74-year-old man recalled in his home about an hour southwest of Bloomington Normal. "He'd lay in bed and couldn't stop moving," recalled Jerry, his wife of 35 years. "He was very agitated. He was sweating and weak, and he couldn't stand up on his own because of the back and neck pain. We had to call an ambulance to take him to the hospital." "It was hell," Larry said. "It was the worst thing I went through in my life." Larry returned to the hospital for more than a week, then spent several weeks in a rehabilitation facility where he was put back on his pain medicine and underwent physical and occupational therapy to regain his strength. He returned home in early 2015. His story illustrates a challenge of Central Illinois' response to the opioid epidemic that includes better control of opioid painkiller prescriptions and decreased societal tolerance for people on opioid painkillers. Yes, there are Central Illinoisans who abuse prescription opioids. Yes, there are people who take heroin, an illegal and highly addictive opioid. But there are thousands of other Central Illinoisans like Marksman who have chronic pain and need to take prescription opioid painkiller along with other treatments and steps to live with chronic pain. "The pain never stops, but it eases up," said Marksman, who described it as a severe, dull pain in his lower back, middle back, and upper back. "It's needed," he said, "of prescription opioids for people with chronic pain, but the doctors need to look at the situation closely and make sure the patient is stable mentally to handle the medication. The patients can't look at it as knocking the pain completely out," added Marksman, a former farmer who was retired after working for the Illinois Department of Agriculture. "It's not a cure-all. It's to knock the pain down to make your life livable." "There is an important role for the opioids," said his wife, retired from the University of Illinois Extension, where she was director of community development. "But other treatments, stress management, and spiritual and emotional support of people around you also have important roles," she said. "We consider what are the puzzle pieces that would bring the best result for Larry," Jerry said, "and those puzzle pieces will be different for everyone." Larry farmed in the Effingham area until his late 30s, when he took a job as a meat inspector with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and relocated to Dawson. He retired in 2005 as a regional administrator. Marksman, who has had back problems for most of his life, was injured in a farming accident at age 24. Two discs in his back were removed and a bone from his hip was fused into the area where the discs had been. "A doctor started me on pain pills then," he said. "It wasn't an opiate. He told me I was going to have back problems in the future." In 1982, he was diagnosed with ankylosing spondylitis, an inherited inflammatory disease that over time had caused some vertebrae in his spine to fuse in his lower back, middle back, and upper neck. He was less flexible, hunched over, and in pain. "There is no cure for the disease, but treatments can lessen the symptoms." "It was kind of a blow," he said. "It's something that'll progress, so you've got to learn to live with it. The key is to stay active, so I stayed active. I looked around, and there were people worse off than I was. They prescribed arthritis medicines, which helped to a point, but they caused stomach problems." As the pain progressed, Larry was prescribed different pain medicine, including OxyContin, an opioid painkiller, morphine, Enbrel, Remicade, fentanyl patches, and then hydrocodone, and tramadol, other opioid pain medicines. They'd help for a while, and then they'd have to increase it, Jerry said. Whenever he had any left, we would take it to the Sangamon County Sheriff's Department for safe disposal. With all the opioids, I welcomed the relief of pain, said Marksman, but I didn't like the side effects. It was a brain fuzziness. I didn't want to be that way. Another side effect was constipation. I had to have my stomach pumped 3 times, he said. In 2015, he went to see Dr. Ramson Benjamin at Millennium Pain Center in Bloomington. We use a comprehensive approach, Benjamin said. We try to minimize opioid medications while maximizing non-opioid alternatives with interventional approaches, medical procedures, and non-interventional such as physical therapy and psychological services. The challenge is there is a lack of good alternatives to opioid medications, he said. We monitor our patients closely. I tell patients if you can work and be productive and enjoy your family and friends, it justifies the treatments. Benjamin suggested an implantable pulse generator, which was implanted under the skin in Larry's upper hip. The generator was connected to small electrodes positioned along his spine. An external remote-controlled device, controlled by Marksman, directs the generator to deliver electrical pulses that interrupt the transmission of pain signals to the brain. The pulse generator has helped to reduce pain. Larry also is on a low dose of methadone, a longer-acting opioid. It doesn't take away the pain, but it takes the edge off, he said. I could take more of it, but I'm willing to live with some pain to minimize the side effects. He also takes Cosentyx, the first medicine approved by the FDA for treatment of ankylosing spondylitis, and a stress reduction meditation class with Jerry twice a week. And he uses a hot tub, spends time outside with his 2 donkeys and mule and in his garden. He wears a back brace when he's outside or driving and tinkers in his workshop. I keep busy to get my mind off the pain. This kind of pain can consume you, Jerry said. You have to look outside yourself. I never start a day without talking to the good Lord, said Marksman. I wouldn't be here without the good Lord. Plea deal reached in Meller murder case. BN woman set to be sentenced on July the 18th in the death of husband. A Bloomington woman will be sentenced in July for second-degree murder after reaching a plea deal Monday in Woodford County Circuit Court in the stabbing death of her husband. Sarah Meller faces a punishment ranging from time served plus 4 years probation to 20 years in prison and up to a $20,000 fine when she is sentenced July the 18th. While I believe our case is very defensible, my client was presented with an option which ultimately could result in a probationary sentence, which is not possible with the charge of first-degree murder, said Meller's attorney Stephanie Wong. The agreement, which Wong described as last minute, was reached after the scheduled start of jury selection. After both the state and the defense announced they were ready for trial on 3 counts of first-degree murder, Judge Michael Stroh granted a recess to discuss a possible plea agreement. When court resumed, the state added a 4th count, second-degree murder. The 3 first-degree murder charges were then dropped. About 70 potential jurors were sent home after noon. On October the 16th, Mark Meller, 31, was stabbed in the chest during a struggle involving a hunting knife while the couple were at a campground near Carlock. He died later at Advocate Broman Medical Center in Normal. State's attorney Greg Minger said that he was satisfied with the plea agreement. During the sentencing phase, I think there will be some testimony which will indicate the reasons why we felt comfortable in dropping from a first-degree charge to a second-degree charge, he said. Previously, Wong said the incident was out of character for her client and said that after Mark Meller was stabbed, his wife drove him to the hospital in the couple's truck. She also emphasized Sarah Meller's long and established ties to the community. She grew up in Bloomington, attended Illinois State University, and, except for 1 year when she taught in Champaign-Urbana, has lived in Bloomington Normal all of her life. At the time of the stabbing, she was a teacher at Bloomington High School. She resigned shortly after being charged. After the hearing, Minger and representatives from the state's attorney's office met with Mark Meller's family. "It's always hard in a case like this because there really is no closure," Minger said. "It's very hard for everyone, and the bottom line is that we can't get Mark back. It's very frustrating." Members of the family declined comment after meeting with Minger. About 24 friends and family members of the Meller family arrived at the courthouse Monday for the trial scheduled first day. A few members of Mark Meller's family were invited inside the courtroom to hear the details of the final plea agreement and were allowed to stay for the formal plea. A Pantograph reporter and about 20 other interested parties were not informed of the developments until those family members left the courtroom. "We apologize for that," said Circuit Court Clerk Lynn Gilbert, who was among those in the hall making sure there were no issues. "I wasn't in the courtroom, and so I am not sure why, but I know that we had a lot of jurors who had been sitting there for a long time, and everybody was concerned with getting them home and everything else in order." Minger said he didn't realize the courtroom was not open to the public until informed by a Pantograph reporter after the hearing. "We were focused on getting the job done, and I know prior to her plea, we wanted to make sure that a couple of members of his family knew what was going on, and so we probably just lost track after that," he said. Sarah Meller remains in custody on $1 million bail. BN victim's lawyer sees Zimmerman as a suspect. When Pam Zimmerman's divorce lawyer heard her client had been fatally shot, her first thought was to contact Bloomington police and share what she knew about Zimmerman's ex-husband. According to the lawyer's testimony Monday in the murder case against Kirk Zimmerman, "My first thought that popped into my head was I need to call Bloomington police because I have statements I need to share with them," the attorney Kathleen Kraft testified at the pretrial hearing for Zimmerman. The 58-year-old suspect is charged with first-degree murder in the shooting death of his ex-wife, whose body was found November the 4th, 2014, in her office on Bloomington's east side. Kraft acknowledged in response to questions from defense lawyer John Rogers that she believes Zimmerman is responsible for the homicide. "I think that's a reasonable analysis, yes," said Kraft, who explained that she declined to speak with a private investigator for the defense because I did not believe my client would have wanted me to. Kraft was one of four witnesses called Monday to testify about statements Pam Zimmerman, 53, allegedly made to them during the couple's tumultuous marriage and contentious divorce. Kraft recounted multiple statements made by Pam Zimmerman in which she expressed fear of her husband of 20 years. She said, "I'm afraid of what he'll do to me," many times during the legal wrangling over finances and custody issues. Rogers inquired about an apparent discrepancy in Pam Zimmerman's expression of fear about taking half of her husband's pension and statements that she wrote in emails to Kirk Zimmerman in which his State Farm pension was mentioned as a bargaining tool for a property settlement in the divorce. "I was not included on this," Kraft said of the email communication sent by the victim in May 2012. Several times during the hearing, Rogers and First Assistant State's Attorney Adam Grist showed obvious signs of frustration with each other. Judge Scott Drzewski suggested that perhaps lunch could be a good cooling-off period and ended the day at 5 p.m. after noting that everybody is getting crabby. The state is asking Drzewski to allow the witnesses to share their recollections of Zimmerman's statements with a jury. Rogers is objecting to testimony that he considers inadmissible hearsay statements. At one point, Rogers referred to another witness, Marla Nucky, as a bit of a runaway witness after the Bloomington woman offered lengthy paraphrases of her conversations with the victim. Nucky was largely unable to recall the specific words used by Pam Zimmerman in talking about her alleged fear of Kirk Zimmerman. Nucky did remember her friend saying, "If anything happens to me, you know who did it," a statement Nucky took as the victim's fear of her ex-husband. The hearing opened with the state handing a subpoena to the suspect's girlfriend, Kate Arthur, as she sat in the courtroom. Arthur was ordered to leave the hearing until after her testimony, expected this morning. Witness Mary Donnelly testified that Pam Zimmerman told her about problems the couple was having before their divorce was filed in 2012. Zimmerman told his wife if she were to file for divorce, she would never see the children again, according to Donnelly's recollection of her conversation with Pam Zimmerman. The hearing is expected to last 3 more days. State Watch. 200-mile budget march steps off. Protesters urging Illinois lawmakers to agree on an annual state budget stepped off on a 200-mile march to Springfield. The march to Springfield got underway at noon Monday. Organizers say the marchers range in age from 23 to 90. They left the James R. Thompson State Office Building in Chicago's Loop. The march is organized by Fair Economy Illinois. It will proceed south along the Interstate 55 corridor. March organizers estimate the protesters will average 13 miles a day and arrive in Springfield May 30th. That's the day before the legislature is scheduled to end its spring session. Democrats who control the General Assembly have been at odds with Republican Governor Bruce Rauner over an annual budget for 2 years. Today in history. Today is Tuesday, May 16th, the 136th day of 2017. There are 229 days left in the year. Today's highlight. On May 16th, 1868, the U.S. Senate failed by one vote to convict President Andrew Johnson as it took its first ballot on the 11 articles of impeachment against him. On this date, in 1770, Marie Antoinette, age 14, married the future King Louis XVI of France, who was 15. In 1866, Congress authorized minting of the first 5-cent piece, also known as the shield nickel. In 1946, the Irving Berlin musical, Annie Get Your Gun, starring Ethel Merman as Annie Oakley, opened on Broadway. In 1957, federal agent Elliot Ness, who organized the Untouchables team that took on gangster Al Capone, died in Countersport, Pennsylvania at age 54. In 1988, the U.S. Supreme Court in California versus Greenwood ruled that police can search discarded garbage without a search warrant. Surgeon General C. Everett Koop released a report declaring nicotine was addictive in ways similar to heroin and cocaine. Thought for today. Those who don't believe in magic will never find it. Written by Roald Dahl, British author, 1916 to 1990. Today's flick fact. Question. In Bloomington Normal, which occupations earns more as a starting wage? 1. Bartenders. 2. Motorcycle mechanics. 3. Postal clerks. 4. Roofers. 5. Taxi drivers. And today's answer is 3. A postal clerk in Bloomington Normal starts at $34,906 a year. The next highest is a roofer at $28,695. Then comes a motorcycle mechanic, $25,457, a taxi driver, $17,302, and a bartender, $14,148. Those are figures based on those accumulated by the Economic Development Council of the Bloomington Normal area. Bloomington Eyes Civilian Review Board. The City Council is open to further research and discussion about a request by the local Black Lives Matter chapter to create a community board to review public complaints about interactions with Bloomington police officers. To summarize, it seems like there is some degree of interest, not universal, in at least exploring some options for an advisory group that might filter complaints, said Mayor Terry Renner after the council's lengthy discussion at its non-voting Committee of the Whole meeting Monday night. For community organizations, not in our town, the YWCA McLean County, NAACP Bloomington Normal, and the Central Illinois chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, support Black Lives Matter Bloomington Normal in calling for a civilian review board. The good thing is it looks like the council is willing to consider it, Quincy Cummings, president of the local NAACP, said after the discussion. I think that the police chief wants to see complaints come in so that he can make improvements, he added. I am a believer in the process, said Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Hefner. I will be open about ways to improve the process for people to file complaints. I look forward to it because what we're doing is communicating and conversing. Gabe Nibergall, an attorney with the city's contracted Springfield law firm, Sorling Northrup, said that there are several options for structuring a civilian review board. One way would be to have such a board review the police department's completed internal affairs investigation, he said. A board also could conduct investigations outside of the police's internal affairs investigation, or it could function more in an auditing, monitoring capacity to make policy recommendations, he said. The investigation supplanting the police internal investigation would run into the most problems with our current force's collective bargaining agreement, Nibergall said. The contract says that you can't reinvestigate an officer-related incident, he said. If a civilian investigation is occurring instead of the police investigation or alongside it, that would be in violation of our current contract. The contract also prohibits officers from being compelled to testify before a civilian review board, Nibergall added. In 2016, 17 people filed complaints against the department, compared to 31 in 2015, police spokesman Elias Mendiola said. Of the 17 complaints, 2 were sustained, meaning there was sufficient evidence of officer wrongdoing, said Mendiola. 8 complaints were not sustained. 1 was found to be unfounded, meaning no evidence was found that the incident occurred, and 6 officers were exonerated of the complaints filed against them. In the center of this page, there's a beautiful picture of 2 people in a fishing boat fishing. The green water and the background of the beautiful trees just looks so peaceful. Underneath it says, Karen Reed, an Air Force veteran from Colorado who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, fishes with Jerry Martoglio of Bloomington at Evergreen Lake on Thursday as part of an outing organized by HUA, Helping Out Our American Heroes. And here's the article that follows. Outing More Than Fishing. Air Force veteran Karen Reed smiles after realizing the irony of saying that she and fellow veterans fishing at Evergreen Lake last week were all in the same kind of boat. She was referring to the similar experiences and adjustment to post-military life of each of the 10 vets who participated in the 3-day fishing outing organized by a local group called HUA, Helping Out Our American Heroes. But actual boats were part of it, too, especially for Army veteran Garfield Pelham of Missouri. Pelham uses a wheelchair and has limited use of one hand. Until last Wednesday, that restricted him to riding on a pontoon boat. But HUA was able to get him on a regular bass boat and provided him with a fishing rod that uses a battery-operated reel, allowing him to control the reel by pushing a button with his finger. Being able to fish from a regular boat may seem small to someone else, but it was big to me, he said. The fishing was just the icing on top. The first thing he did was reach over the side and splash his hand in the water. I felt like a kid again, said Pelham. His enthusiasm brought smiles to the veterans and the volunteers from groups such as the McLean County Sportsmen Association and Prairieland Anglers. When we first started the program, I thought we were doing something nice, just getting them out hunting or fishing, said Tom Huffington of McLean, who co-founded the group with Matt Graydon of Stanford. Soon he learned it was more than that. The mental healing that happens out there is something else, he said. Reed, who lives in Colorado and did three tours in Iraq and two tours in Afghanistan, said, "We can relax around each other." Praising the organizers, Reed said it's not what they do, but how they do it. The 10 of us had not met each other before, but 24 hours later, we're sharing stories. The stories are often ones they can't or don't want to share with their families, but feel comfortable talking about with fellow veterans, she said. Guys can sit and cry, they can hug, and no one judges you, said Reed. There also was a lot of good-natured kidding and real competition involving who would catch the biggest and the most fish. Nathan Flory, an Army veteran from Clinton, said, "It's relaxing for one thing. It gets you away from the day-to-day grind of things." When Huffington and Graydon started the group in 2013, it was affiliated with a program at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, called HUA, Healing Outside of a Hospital. Although the name has changed slightly, the mission is still the same, not just giving vets recreation options, but also helping them network and build friendships. Noting statistics that say 22 veterans take their lives each day, Huffington said, "Our ultimate goal is to cut that 22. The group organizes not only fishing trips, but also deer and pheasant hunts, said Huffington. It also looks for adaptive equipment to help the veterans with disabilities. This can be a battery-operated rod and reel, a bow with a winch-like mechanism that needs the strength of just one finger, or an all-terrain wheelchair. The main fundraising comes from two golf tournaments a year, one in Pontiac and one in Southern Illinois. I can't say enough about the guys who put this together," said Reed. New fire station to open in October. Normal officials, staff, tour construction site. The new Normal Fire Department headquarters station is set to take on a big burden right away. If I showed you a map of where all our calls are, about half of them are within 3 or 4 blocks of here. So this station is going to take on the lion's share of emergency calls, said Fire Chief Mick Humer of the station at 606 South Main Street near Illinois State University. It couldn't be in a better location. The $4 million station is set to open in October as the first part of an 8 to 10 year plan starting last year to replace and relocate all three Normal stations. That plan is expected to significantly improve response times, not only to ISU, but to Northeast Normal. We decided that if we moved all the stations so that we had better response times, we would not need to build a fourth fire station and add 12 to 18 people to the fire department. You can build a lot of fire stations for the amount of money hiring 12 to 18 people, Humer said. The plan is finish a station, start planning buying the land, doing all that in about 2 years in between. In the meantime, Humer is thrilled by the possibilities of the new headquarters, which will replace Station 2 at 604 North Adelaide Street. That land is promised to ISU as part of a land swap and take on administrative offices from the current headquarters at 1300 East College Avenue. The facility is nearly 30,000 square feet, much bigger than the 11,000 square foot Station 2, and has several new and upgraded features, including a training room that can hold 100, a state-of-the-art training room, and a rooftop area overlooking Main Street to the south. "We've had a lot of interest from different agencies throughout the state in using that training room," he said, during a tour for town staff and elected officials on Monday. "With this new weight room, we may not have to use outside gyms, which would be a great asset for us in our wellness program." Hoomer referred to the facility as a big pill to swallow for taxpayers, but a worthwhile investment that should be here for 50 years. Station 2 was built in 1976 and lasted about 40 years. The only thing hard for me to believe is that it's ours, Hoomer said of the station with a laugh. We've come now to the end of the first half hour of the Pantograph. We'll take a short break. Please stay tuned.